to Critic Proof. I'm Alyssa Rosenberg, the critic at Think Progress and a columnist for Slate. And I'm joined today by my dear friend, Scott Mieslow, who is the entertainment editor of that fine publication, The Week. And we are here to talk two of television's biggest shows, which return within a week of each other, Mad Men and Game of Thrones. And let's start off with Game of Thrones, which premiered this weekend. What did you think of the first episode, which brings us both a lot of ice zombies and dragons soaring over the ocean and slaves and all sorts of assorted Lannister drama?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to even know where to start. You've done a pretty good job summarizing, but I was impressed. I was really, really happy with the way they started off the season. I'm a book reader. I know you are, too, so I'm kind of familiar with where it's going.
Yes.
Let's put a
spoiler warning on this section of the conversation for people who are watching Game of Thrones but have not read the books, because we might discuss changes between the books and the television show.
Right. At least for the first episode.
Sure. One of the big changes is Jon Snow, the former member of the Night's Watch, the bastard son of Ned Stark, who last season killed a member of the Night's Watch so he would be credible when he goes over to hang out with the wildlings, the large collective of nomads and giants and hot redheaded chicks, hot redheaded fellows for those of you who lean in that direction, who live sort of beyond civilization. They're sort of like they're basically an Occupy Westeros movement. They're heading south. And John, in the books, initially tells Mance Rayder, the sort of charismatic leader of the wildlings, that he wants to join their ranks because he's been sort of socially marginalized as a bastard. In the show, he insists that he sort of wants to join them because he believes that the sort of institutions of Westeros have been complacent in the face of this sort of growing threat to the realm. What did you
make
of the difference?
I'm very in favor of many of the changes that they've made. I know that's been controversial for book readers, but I think this is kind of a classic example of streamlining in a way that makes sense for the show in terms of representing quickly to the viewers that there is this huge threat that no one is really paying attention to in the same way. You know, the question of Jon's parentage is an important one and an interesting one, but in terms of pressing stuff for the show to deal with, I would bring it in now. I like the idea. What did you think?
Yeah. I agree with you about edits to the book, and I think that one of the things that's really interesting about sort of the state of fantasy writing right now is that it seems relatively clear to me that once franchises get off the ground, the authors aren't edited particularly heavily. I thought that was fairly obviously the case with J.K. Rowling in the Harry Potter series, that once she'd sort of found her voice, they were going to let her do 200 pages of camping in the woods if that was what she wanted to do. And I think that seems fairly clearly the case of George R. R. Martin, if only because I feel like editing him and checking him for continuity and getting him to sort of let go of his heraldry fixation would be sort of one editor's full-time job. And so I feel like, you know, Benioff and Weiss, the guys who created Game of Thrones for HBO, have sort of been filling in and editing the books in a way that Martin's editors or agent, I think, don't really have time to do. And Brian Cogman, who's the story editor, have been sort of looking at the, you know, where the book series is actually going, I assume based on conversations that they've had with Martin himself, and saying, you know what, we can streamline this thing. We don't need this red herring to go on for four more books because it's not going to lead anywhere, so we can wrap up sooner. And I think that's
important.
Well,
I think we all agree that this is an overstuffed story as is. Overstuffed, I guess, sounds more critical than I want it to, but we don't have a ton of extra time, and the red herrings that you can spread out over 1,200 pages don't work the same way in 10 hours of television.
Yeah.
I think it helps that Martin is a producer and enthusiastic fan of the show, because I think the changes made fit pretty well with the narrative he was already telling to me, and I assume that he's making sure that they're not setting up anything in the show that will somehow screw up what he's doing in the books later. They're going to roughly follow continuity.
Right.
And I think the other thing I like about these changes, and it doesn't apply specifically to the one that we're talking about, but the idea that we're seeing all of these people in a way that we couldn't because of how the books are written with these point of view chapters. I think a lot of the best scenes for me are ones that we never could have seen in the show. You know, the first season had that incredible scene with Robert and Cersei. that one of my favorite scenes of the season that couldn't have happened in the books because neither of them had narrated a chapter in Game of Thrones, the first book.
Right. Well, and I think this is an interesting question. I think my friend Alan Sepinwall wrote, I think in his review of the show, that Game of Thrones kind of tests the extent to which a television show can function like a novel, right? I mean, people talk about The Wire as sort of potentially the great American novel, the show that sort of demonstrates the novelistic long arc storytelling potential of the medium. But compared to Game of Thrones, it's relatively contained. You have a lot of players, but they're in each season all sort of woven into a single central plot. Things come to a conclusion at the end of every section. And, you know, so as long as you're paying reasonable attention, you don't need to skip back and forth between episodes that much, right? I mean, you might forget who Brother Muzon, the, you know, sort of Nation of Islam assassin who shows up in season two is by the time he reappears in season three, but you're probably going to be reminded fairly quickly by the dialogue. I don't know that that's the case with Game of Thrones, and it's been interesting as someone who's read the books to see people who watch the show ping me and say, who is this guy? I just don't remember at all. How is he connected to this? You know, I don't know if you've done this with critic friends of your own, but I feel like I've spent a lot of time sort of acting as a living Westeros.org for people who just can't keep track because it's really hard to keep track. And I love the additional points of view, but Game of Thrones seems like a text that's hard to manage if you can't like flip back and forth in the chapters.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I tend to give the show a pass because I think at this point you're all in, or why are you watching it?
Yeah,
I think this is doing something really unique on the landscape. That why would you pick up season 3, episode 1 of Game of Thrones?
Yeah,
but to a degree, yeah, the series is just a giant rabbit's hole, and you can go as far down it as you want. You can literally spend days after days trolling the forums, reading obscure theories and arcana, and I have.
Yeah,
and I came into the show. You'd read the series from the start, right?
Yes, my lovely readers, to all of you out there, insisted 4 or 5 years ago that I read the books, and so I read all of them that had been released at the time and wrote a big essay series on them, and so I was sort of down the rabbit hole already when the show came out.
And the way it worked for me, I committed to covering the show before I had read the books and did the first season without ever touching the books. Which was a really interesting way to do it. HBO, thank God, with their screener set, sent along this kind of exhaustive guide to the characters and families. And I remember watching the first few episodes and thinking, how is anyone going to follow this show if they haven't read the books and don't have this huge guide?
Yeah.
Like this 30-page pamphlet that I can look through.
Yeah.
And then between seasons, I read the books because readers kept saying, we'd prefer if you can make some comparisons, that kind of thing. But I...
Yeah.
I wonder what it's like at this point, and if I think the question with the show that continues to stay true is how much can you avoid spoilers? Because I realized it was going to be impossible for me.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say, you know, we've seen both of us have seen the first 4 episodes of season 3 of Game of Thrones, and there are events that happen in the first 4 episodes that are sort of enormous, really striking, moving set pieces that, you know, I'd read 3 or 4 times because I'm an obsessive person and reread fantasy novels that I love. But I think we're still staged in ways that were effective and extremely sort of visually striking and surprising. And for me, it's a show, again, you know, I pretty much know everything that's going to happen, but as the scope of it has expanded, the show's ability to surprise me has kind of confirmed my I don't care at all about spoilers position. Like, I really...
Right.
And that, I mean, I think that makes me somewhat unusual as both a critic and a viewer. I could not care less at all. You know,
And what in the first season, or the first episode in particular, surprised you or stood out to you as a book reader?
I thought that... So I think one thing the show has done really well this season is responded to criticism that it was sort of throwing out nudity, particularly female nudity, as filler in the show. And I think one of the most gratifying things to me is the development of 2 characters who are both extremely marginal in the books and who are never granted point of view status. Like, the story's never told through their eyes. And those are Roz, a prostitute who is sort of from Winterfell, and who in the books is sort of there and then is forgotten. She never makes her way to the capital. She doesn't play a larger role in the story, at least in the books that we've seen. She's just sort of marginal. And here she moves to the capital, becomes a prostitute in sort of an upscale brothel, is, you know, abused by the king, and then in this season has really become a player in her own right. She's not working as a sex worker anymore. She's sort of, you know, an advisor and facilitator for Littlefinger, who's the court treasurer. And so seeing someone sort of move through that occupation, that level of social mobility is not available to sex workers in Martin's world, really. And then the other character is Shy, who in the books is a camp follower who becomes the sort of lover of Tyrion Lannister, and again, doesn't have a point of view chapter, and here becomes the maid to Sansa Stark, this noblewoman from the north, who's sort of a captive in King's Landing, but whose hand in marriage is still a very sort of valuable possession. And watching those two characters together, sort of discussing their roles, discussing the people they advise, and just sort of watching those women become players was really, really gratifying in the first episode for me. I thought that was great. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I loved just kind of the nonchalant introduction of the giants.
Yeah.
I think to me, what I love about this season, the way they've started off, it just feels more confident than it has before,
yeah,
in terms of, we know our fans, we know what they're doing, we know what we're doing, and so, you know, whereas the show, I think, would have been very reluctant in the first season, or at least would have taken the development of something like that seriously. It's, oh, by the way, there are giants. Here they are. They exist beyond the wall. And I think that's been so carefully but logically integrated into the world. It feels like there's a really sure hand on the wheel.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting just because, obviously, you know, The Walking Dead is smashing the ratings. It's got, you know, 8.4 million viewers in the 18 to 49 demographic, which would make most broadcast network executives die of happiness.
Right.
But we're really not long into this period where fantasy is viable enough on cable for people to spend a lot of money on it. And fantasy is expensive. I mean, Game of Thrones runs $50 or $60 million a year for 10 episodes, as opposed to 50 or 60 episodes a year for 22 to 24 episodes. And so,
right,
you know, it is, we're really new into this point where I think that, you know, networks can do these shows and make these commitments at all, and where shows have sort of taught viewers to watch them enough that they can go for something like The Giants and sort of take it for granted.
Yeah, and I think the gambits that I've seen in the episodes we've seen so far have worked.
Yeah.
I think there's a real trust in the people watching the show at this point that just keep up. And trust us, we'll trust you to pay enough attention and to care enough about this that you won't jump ship. And I think that kind of relationship between the creative team and understanding its fan base has just been really gratifying to watch.
Yeah. I mean, it's also an interesting example of sort of how low the bar is between, or sort of how low the barriers are between creators and fans. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's interesting. I think you and I both deal with people who get very upset about changes to the books.
Yes.
And, I mean, how do you react to people like that? Because I never quite know what to say. We've talked about sort of, I'm very comfortable with edits to the books, but people really view this as some kind of holy writ.
I think it really depends on what kind of fan you are and what you're looking for. I'm not the kind of person who cares to read an exhaustive list of everything that was changed from the books to the TV show. I think those things exist, and I'm glad they're out there for people who want that take on the show, but I'm interested in what the show's doing in its own right. There's a part of me that kind of actually has regrets about reading the books at this point.
Yeah,
I was probably in a strange way, if not more engaged in a different way that I thought might have been more interesting with the show before I knew where it was going. Watching the first season, I remember when I wrote my review of the finale, I talked about how, oh, like, it's going to be so great when Arya gets to the wall and she's there, you know, she'll see Jon Snow again and they have this great relationship. And I, you know, immediately got this kind of scathing email from a fan saying, oh, but she never makes it. It's like, oh, like, my mind, the way that I engaged with the show was so much more On a plot level, I was thinking so much more about where it could go, and where my mind was spinning it was more interesting to me. I mean, not more interesting than what ends up happening, but interesting in that I could come up with a half dozen possibilities.
Do you think...
as opposed to... Yeah, go
ahead. Do you think that you were more hopeful? Because the idea of, like, Arya and Jon getting a Chipper reunion is fairly optimistic in contrast to, you know, what tends to happen to those characters. And
it feels very naive now that I look back on it, but that was kind of how I was watching the show. And that happened, obviously, right after one of the first huge tragedies, Ned getting killed.
Yeah.
Which I was very surprised by, which I think I have wonderful readers and friends who didn't spoil that for me, so I got to experience that.
Yeah.
But it's such a different way to watch a TV show, in a way that didn't even really exist before this kind of book to TV adaptation thing was becoming more common. And very, even now, like, you know, I review The Walking Dead at the week as well, and I know what happens in the comic books, but it doesn't really help you that much.
Yeah.
In the same way that Game of Thrones does. It gives you the broad strokes, but, you know, Game of Thrones has its deviations, but you know it's always going to return to the core story that you already know.
Yeah. I mean, I think coming back to the idea of sort of surprises and hopefulness, I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting about Game of Thrones is the way in that, even though it's set in the fantasy genre, it kind of functions as a critique of fantasy, right? And
absolutely.
I think it takes a long time for, I mean, certainly in the books, it took me a long time to get used to the idea that every time I saw the potential for sort of a fairy tale happy ending or a partnership that would go well, I was going to be wrong. And right. I wonder, I mean, I'm curious for people who aren't reading the books, whether they're there yet, you know? I mean, sort of two seasons in. And, you know, I think you and I both know how much darker things can get, as do other readers of the books.
Absolutely.
And I'm curious as to where people are in that learning process.
Yeah, and I talked to a lot of people about the show, a lot of whom haven't read the books and don't know where it's going. Maybe I'm naive because I still look for happy endings. I mean, we talk about reading the books, but we're only midway through the story, you and I. We have as much as we can, but there are still two more books coming, and I'm
at least two
in
more
my
books
mind
coming,
I haven't closed
I think.
The door on a happy ending. Yeah, at least two and maybe three and maybe 100. But yeah, I think no matter how bad things have gotten in the story at times, I'm still thinking about where things can go from book five and thinking it's not all bad, maybe.
What do you
think? We'll find out.
But if part of the project of, you know, Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire, as the book series is known, is to critique fantasy, what can a happy ending look like within that critique? I mean, does the Brotherhood Without Banners, are the peasants going to rise up? Are we going to see gender equality in Westeros? Like, what does a happy ending look like that still critiques the norms of fantasy?
Yeah, and I think the examples you listed would be very out of step with the story Martin's telling. I think one of the things that I really admire about the world George R. R. Martin has created, and that you can't totally get a feel for in the show, and they've done a great job with what they've done, but there is such a history here. And I would be content with a happy ending that acknowledges tragedies have happened in the past, and this happy ending is temporary, because they all are.
Yeah.
There's a world with a real history, you know, a story only has a happy ending because that's where we stop it.
Yeah.
And there's lots of great work going on right now critiquing in that super cliched version, I guess, would be the what happens after happily ever after.
Right.
But I think in this world in particular, there's a much smarter version of that to be told where we can reach some kind of relative peace or some resolution for these characters tinged with regret and bitterness that still honors the story that's been told so far. And I don't want to talk in too much detail because I don't want to, I'll confine it to the show unless you think we should open it up.
No, I mean, I do think, you know, in general terms, one of the things that's interesting, as much as I think Martin's building of this world has gotten kind of out of control, and I almost feel like he's spending more time kind of opening up new sections of the map than actually advancing the story, is that we see in the books worlds that function differently than Westeros, right? I mean, we see slave societies like Astapor, the city that Dany marched into in this first episode. And we see sort of island cities where things are more equitable and sex workers have more power. Or, you know, Volantis, a city that turns out to be like a freed slaves that, you know, shows up in A Dance with Dragons. And so there are these reminders. The world building is actually in some ways more hopeful than the events of the books themselves, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, you're right. That's interesting. And or the Citadel, you know, this kind of learned place. I think I have a, you know, kind of a complicated relationship with those things in the book because there's a part of me that likes, I love the world building. I love the complexity and of the world, but I do have that drive as a reader to, you know, okay, let's get back to things.
Get moving. Let's get moving. We need fewer characters, not more of them.
The way that, like, I would have been very irritated when I read Lord of the Rings if the Silmarillion had been the third book instead of Return of the King, and we'd spent this big transition learning all about the world of Middle-earth.
Right.
I have the sense that George R. R. Martin, like you said, with that, because I can't imagine he's edited almost at all at this point, at least in terms of cutting the books down. Specifically, which I think most readers would agree, Feast for Crows gets very meandering.
Yeah. A Dance with Dragons is all over the place. I mean, A Dance with Dragons is functionally a road trip book.
Right. Absolutely. And we spend almost no time in what's up to that point been the central crux of the story.
Yeah.
And it's, I'll always read it. It's always interesting, but I would like to see it edited down a little more. I would like to get going at this point and earlier, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, I can see sort of the television show being ultimately the edited version where, you know, the books are something you read if you want to sort of meander around. They're almost a, you know, I would never suggest that they're secondary because obviously they're the source material. But, you know, the television show is the sleeker narrative version of the story.
Yeah, it's a very different experience. And speaking hypothetically of a time when both the show and the books have concluded, I would go to them for very different things.
Yes.
You know? The TV show would be, this is the streamlined version, this is the quick fix, and the books are, I just want to hang out in Westeros for a month, and I'll just, you know, put this on my book on my nightstand and pick it up whenever I want to hang out.
Well, and I mean, I feel so torn because obviously I want George R. R. Martin to get a move on because I need to know how all of this ends. It's driving me crazy. But, you know, there have been talks of sort of a prequel show or, you know, more prequel stories, and I could just hang out in this place forever, you know? I mean, there are all of these, and in a way I wish that, you know, something could happen like the Star Wars Expanded Universe where people just get to take up residence in some of these towns and write story collections about them, you know, do something like Will Shatner.
I agree, and I think that's the long-term answer. I think if we look at the broader scope of the series, it will end and Westeros will become the latest playground.
It's true.
And, you know, I'm looking forward to that. I'm enjoying the phase we're in right now, and I certainly don't want to rush it along.
Yes.
But it's so well realized.
Right.
Both in TV and on the page.
No,
I want to see why other people shouldn't play around in there.
Absolutely. Now to switch courses from a long time ago in a climactically complicated continent far, far away, to a more distant or a more close playground, the 1960s, Mad Men is back on Sunday, and I have to admit, I think the show is wearing out my patience. I should also confess at the beginning that I have never loved Mad Men as much as everyone else, but the show, and we are abiding by some heavy spoiler restrictions imposed on us by AMC, is kind of going in circles.
Right. Yeah, I think in this conversation, I'm the one who's much more of, I guess on the baseline of the critical perspective on Mad Men. I am a huge fan. I've been a huge fan for a while. I mean, I remember watching season one, episode one premiere.
Yeah.
I've stuck with the show. I've pretty much, with occasional disappointments, I'm very impressed with it. But in this case, I agree. I've kind of learned to trust where the show is going at this point. And appreciated it's playing a long game, but I was a little frustrated by the premiere.
Well, and I guess my question is, you know, so often we've seen, you know, Don repeat patterns. We've seen Peggy sort of enter into Don's circle and start to act more like him. We've seen Roger Sterling divorce one wife after another and sort of continue to be miserable. You know, I mean, I can only watch these people repeat their patterns for so often, and if there's an endgame, there needs to be some breaking of that pattern, right? I mean, my right. assumption has always been that Don Draper dies at the end, that Don Draper is the man falling out the window. And maybe that's wrong, but it's an awfully provocative
I hope you're wrong.
Image to put out there. You want Don to live? Mm-hmm. Don is such a miserable
person. I don't care whether he lives or dies. I don't care where they leave. I mean, he's dead. If we look at the show in a realistic context, he's dead or very, very old. But I don't like the idea of, oh, that imagery in the opening credits was him all along. It just seems lazy.
It's literal.
It seems obvious.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah. In a way that I don't find very interesting, in a way that maybe I think of Mad Men as a subtler show at times than you seem to.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to find it a little obvious.
It's getting more like that.
Yeah, I mean, Don is literally reading the Inferno. In this in this episode of the show. That's not on the spoiler list, right? I don't think
that. No, I think the first 30 seconds are okay. He's reading Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, and I mean, seriously,
it's a way that people do when they want some leisurely reading. I agree.
Like,
I've got a problem with that.
It's literally a midlife crisis book, right?
Yeah.
And I guess the question is, if the show has concluded that Don Draper is incapable of growth, what is his mm-hmm. narrative arc? Does that make any sense? I mean, I think that people can stagnate and still be pulled along by events, but I don't understand what Don Draper's arc is anymore.
Well, it seems to me, I agree with you. I think the ultimate message of Mad Men, unless it's find some way to subvert it, which, I mean, to me, I can't imagine a way that would feel anything but dishonest to the story that they've been telling. But I think the message seems to be people don't change. People try to change. They try to be better versions of themselves, but in the end, they return to what they are.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting story. It's not a story not worth telling. I don't know if it has to be told this long.
Right. And it's the kind of thing that strikes me that can be told perhaps over a single grand arc over mm-hmm. 4 or 5 seasons. I'm not sure. I feel like there are diminished returns after a while from telling it in the same sort of concentric circle again and again. And that worries me some.
I mean, it strikes me that this to me is also kind of the ultimate message of The Sopranos, which went on exactly as long, not exactly episode by episode, but roughly 7 seasons, basically
right.
what Mad Men is doing. And of course, that's where Matt Weiner cut his teeth.
I wonder if there's
some echoing, not deliberately, but of that narrative structure of the lessons that he learned there, and saying this is the length and the type of story that I want to tell with this protagonist. I'm going to tease the fact that he might be redeemable before ultimately saying he's not.
Yeah.
He never was.
I mean, I think that's possible, too. The other thing, the other thing that I wonder whether the show is building to, and has always sort of been a question for me, the extent to which the show is actually about sort of feminism and women and sort of Don Draper's loss of privilege. Because, I mean, it's interesting if the show ends up arguing to a certain extent that Peggy, as she sort of extends up the creative ranks, ascends up the creative ranks, becomes more like Don because that is inevitable when you have power. I mean, it could end up being a very interesting and sort of disappointing take on feminism that, you can only make progress within institutions, but you can't actually change them.
Right.
You will always be captured by them. And, to a certain extent, Mad Men is a more interesting show to me if it ends up being about Peggy rather than Don, but I don't really think that that's mm-hmm. borne out by the overall sort of structure of the show or the allocation of time within it or mm-hmm. anything else. And if Don Draper,
I think you're right. I think this is why so many people have pointed to Sally as the possible out here, in that if the show, if we look forward to any kind of, not a positive message, but a sign that things can change and will change, that Sally is kind of the real person with the arc in this series, and Don is kind of a cipher for, or a vessel for us to explore that arc.
Maybe, although they have...
I think that's a bit of an optimistic read on what the show has done.
And they have so little relationship,
But I think...
Last season when Sally gets her period, she wants to go home to her mother, who she sort of hates in an active way. But at least there's a depth mm-hmm. of the emotion there, where Don is sort of the nice man who shows up with ice cream.
Sure. I mean, I think Sally's relationship with Don is all but irrelevant at this point in the show.
Yeah.
But I think the idea of Don was the thing we used to trick you to watch this show about a young girl growing up in this tempestuous era is a provocative idea, if not one that I think is borne out by what the show is doing so far.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other problem with that is that Sally is too young to really be caught up in any of the cultural ferment. I mean, we hear her teacher talking about reading a Martin Luther King speech to her class, but I mean, and it would be very cliche to do a sort of teenager gets swept up in the 60s thing unless you were going to do sort of American pastoral, which would be amazing. But, you know, Sally is, I mean, I think reaches real teenagedom after a lot of the seminal changes are sort of underway, if that makes any sense. She can be a beneficiary of them, but, you know, has
kind of been excluded. The timeline doesn't quite line up if that's the type of story that they're telling.
Yeah. And, I mean, there's just not enough sort of allocation of time. I mean, I think that, you know, Don is the main character of Mad Men, and that, for me, has always been sort of the problem of Mad Men, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree, and I think I would have disagreed with you even a season ago.
Yeah.
I know the fifth season was kind of polarizing. I would say it was the most impressive to me. That was my favorite season of the show, partially because I found Don so much more interesting than he'd been in a while.
Right.
And kind of watching him fight his instincts and trying to mount this new life.
Yeah.
But in whether, you know, there's a part of me that thinks that final scene, if the message they want to say is, Don can't change, and this is how people are. That was a great final shot to end on.
Right.
That could have been a series finale, and I could have put the series away and accepted that that's what it was about. But I'm not sure what's left to say in these 2 years.
Yeah.
I think I have more faith than you do that there's a light at the end of that tunnel.
Mm. Well, is there anything in particular you want to see happen in this season that would sort of restore your faith in the show?
Yeah, I mean, without talking about the premiere, I think they have characters that give them really interesting possibilities to explore. I think I'm really hopeful that they're going to do something interesting with Megan this season.
Mm.
I like where we find her in the premiere. I like the storylines that it opens, and I like what it will do to her relationships with the other characters on the show.
Right.
In some ways I agree with you in that I would love to see Don pushed to the periphery, marginalized, much like he has been in the last season in his actual business as he kind of was on his marriage leave. Let the younger people in the firm step up. Let Don, who used to be this kind of wonder kind, treated as a god by everybody, prove himself sort of irrelevant and make him a supporting character in an ensemble show about who else we have left. I mean, I like Sally is great. I'm much more interested in Betty this season than I am in Don.
Yeah. No, I think Betty, I'm the rare Betty lover. And, you know, I think that as a show about sort of the damage that men like Don do to women like Betty, I think that that's sort of a remarkable show. And Betty's sort of curdled ambitions and interests, are just a remarkable tapestry, and so I am I'm hopeful that we'll get to see more of her and maybe get to see her step out a little bit from some of the shadows that have been cast over her.
And I'm on your side with Betty.
Yeah. No, I think she's fascinating. We are running out of time, but thank you so much for joining me, and hopefully we can check back in after the premiere on Sunday and see what's happened from there.
Absolutely. This has been a blast. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the time.